Undercurrents Radio can be heard on CIUT 89.5 FM on Thursday mornings from 1 a.m. till 6 a.m. Now stay tuned for Undercurrents TV. Hi, I'm Hans Bergschmidt, and you're watching Undercurrents Television on McLean Hunter Community Cable TV. Undercurrents TV is the direct result of a radio program that started over 2 years ago on CIUT 89.5 FM. The show was called Groundswell and can still be heard on Monday mornings from 11 o'clock in the morning till noon. Groundswell is a show dedicated to bringing you the most controversial and interesting speakers from the alternative media, speakers such as Noam Chomsky, John Stockwell, Maud Barlow, and many, many others. We're very, very happy to have this opportunity to offer some of these people on television. As an offshoot of the Groundswell program, an all-night backgrounding show developed called Undercurrents. Undercurrents, again, can be heard on CIUT 89.5 FM on Thursday mornings from 1 a.m. till 6 a.m. That's a full 5 hours of material. Undercurrents, as an extension of Groundswell, is produced by a collective of people that have a commitment to access, to network, and distribute this type of information, which often doesn't make its way to the mainstream. And after watching a few of these shows, you can see why. We have a tendency to step on a few people's toes and say things that wouldn't go over too well on mainstream media. So we're very happy to have this opportunity to present this. I encourage you to tell your friends. I encourage you to network this information. Audio tapes of today's program and for the next 5 weeks' programs of John Judge are available through the Undercurrents Collective. Please write to CIUT 89.5 FM, 91 St. George Street, M5S2E8. That's in Toronto. Or if you'd like to get involved with Undercurrents, if you hear and see things on TV here that you really feel strongly about and you're really glad that we're getting out and you'd like to be part of it, you can do so by writing to the same number and letting us know what you'd like to do. We'd like to have you on board because we do need the research and we do need the distribution. That's Undercurrents. And now it's a television show, again, thanks to McLean Hunter TV. Tonight, on our first show, I'm very pleased to present author and historian John Judge. John Judge is perhaps one of the most audacious critics of American domestic and foreign policy. John Judge was in Toronto this August on the 9th and the 10th. He spoke at the University of Toronto. The first night he spoke on who really runs America and gave a brief history of the origins of the U.S. intelligence agency and the role George Bush played in the underground government that exists in America. The second night he spoke on the JFK assassination, and what you will see in future programs I know will astound you. John has been doing research for over 22 years. Both of his parents worked in the Pentagon, and he practically grew up in the Pentagon library. So he has a very strong background in this type of information. His key focuses of the research that he does is the JFK assassination, the fascist origins of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Jonestown murders. And we'll be hearing a bit of all of that coming up over the next 5 weeks. It's my pleasure to present on McLean Hunter Community Cable TV the Undercurrents TV show with John Judge.
Thanks for the warm welcome, and welcome to all of you to the New World Order. As my friend Wendy Govier, who's going to be speaking with me tomorrow night, says, it's all governments against all people. Hitler had a vision of a world rule and a thousand-year Reich, and he even had a name for it in German, Die Neue Weltordnung. It translates a new world order. And that's just exactly the same world order that George Bush, an agent of fascism and repression, one of the biggest drug dealers in the world, Mad Dog Bush, Killer Bush, I can't say enough for him, has brought with him in his now, I believe, over 10-year administration in the White House. I believe he became president March 31st, 1980, and we'll get back to that date. And if you haven't gotten the message, when the head of one of the most powerful and genocidal secret police intelligence agencies in the world, the Central Intelligence Agency, then becomes president of the most powerful and destructive nation on Earth, I get the message. Wendy and I both have family roots here in Canada, and coming in on the plane, we had to fill out custom forms, and they prohibit bringing in certain things. And she said, leaned over to me and said, we might not get in with your stuff. And I said, what is it? And she said, articles from an endangered species, and pointed to my book bag. As I say in one of my talks, we're not just endangered, we're dead already, at least in their plans. And the topic that Patrick promoted this for tonight was who really runs America? And part of that answer right now is George Bush and company. And I feel, though, that there's no reason to remove Bush totally from the broader perspective of recent history and of the escalating fascism in the United States since the end of World War II. And there's really no way to make sense, I think, of Bush and his connections without going over some of that history. So I'd like to start with that, a little bit of overview of my particular worldview. But I believe in order to get what's happening, you need a scorecard, and you need an introduction to the key players and to the rules of the game. And so I'd like to start with that. It's a quick course for you fast learners. And I'd ask you to suspend judgment for a few minutes, because maybe for most of you it's a whole new context of looking at the world situation. The facts are the same, but I put them in a slightly different order, with a few extra ones that seem to have been ignored by most of the mainstream media and even much of the research community. But I think when they're in that order, you can sort it out. So I'd like to steal the target of the modern era, the space between your ears, that George Orwell talked about. For a little while, the system and the schools and the television have had it a good lot longer than I have, I'm sure. And so I thought I'd start to go over that history a little bit from an article that I did some time ago to sum it up and to try to introduce these people, called Good Americans. And it's reproduced as the first article in this new collection that Patrick just put together, Judge for Yourself. I think that the problem really stems back to the successful revolution in the Soviet Union about 1917. The Romanov family was spirited out of the country with all the treasury, the money. The monarchists around the world were concerned. The White Russian counter-revolutionaries were working to put themselves back in power. Colonial powers in France and Germany and England saw the handwriting on the wall, and even the United States saw the tremendous wealth in the Soviet Union as a prize worth regaining or eventually winning. So from 1918 to 1932, that royal treasury, as well as funds that were collected from these rich monarchist families and the industrialists, led by Herbert Hoover, who spent actually more time in Europe than he did in the United States, but became president of the United States. These monies were poured into the secret rearmament of post-World War I Germany, with the specific purpose, I believe, of aiming Germany then back at Russia to take the mother country away from the Bolshevik rule. And these networks formed international relations. They had an international group known as the Solidarists, who figure out through that whole period and up into the current era. They have little different names now, but it's basically the same connection. And another major force that wanted to change the history that happened there in the Soviet Union was the Vatican, who, among other things, relied on an alleged apparition of the Virgin Mary at Fatima, who warned the Pope, supposedly, that the Tsar would fall and evil forces would come to rule. This sort of Catholic propaganda was used quite successfully later in Vietnam by Edwin Lansdale, one of the top CIA propagandists and psychological warfare experts, to try to get people to go south after the 1954 agreement to divide the country in half. These were also within the Catholic Church probably the most reactionary and conservative elements of that church. They had still ideas that supported the Inquisition in Spain. They were people who used flagellation as prayer. And they formed a lay order within the church known as the Opus Dei, or Works of God. And they were joined also by an even older military order in the church, a secretive group known as the Knights Hospitalliers, and more recently as the Knights of Malta. And their ultimate objective was to bring down the Soviet Union, and no method or means was too extreme. They then went about helping fascists rise to power in Spain, the Franco government, Mussolini in Italy, and Hitler in Germany. And United States firms also had financial trade and dealings. U.S. banks had dealings with the pre-World War II German emerging fascist rule, supporting them through international credit banks. But this drive, which then took us into World War II and the deaths of almost 80 million people during that period, failed at Stalingrad in 1943. Tremendous cost within the Soviet Union, 22 million in that war, 22 million dead, and they were forced at that point to realize they weren't going to win the whole of the Soviet Union back, and so plans were made in 1943 to retrench and to put their forces back together. They added to their ranks at that point the embittered revanchists of Eastern Europe, the Cold Warriors and the Klansmen here in the United States, and even worse, more fascistic elements here and around the world. I think the real secret history of World War II, yet to be told, is that it was really a war against the emergence of fascism worldwide by democratic forces. Unfortunately, they basically just held for a period and are now beginning, I think, finally to fall completely. But from 1943 on, then, we went into the escalation of this Cold War propaganda that determined the domestic and foreign policy of the United States and the paramilitary spying of that period, with the idea eventually of a final exchange, which would, given the technology, be nuclear in the future. And there was no real goal to them as important as recapturing Mother Russia into the monarchist and fascist hands. But in addition to that, they had now the added eugenicists and the fascists of the Third Reich and their scientific racism and their genocidal technologies, who saw most of the non-white world as expendable. In addition, then, to this international fascist cabal at the end of World War II, we have to add these elements, and they include a group that remained in Germany called Kameradenwerk, and two groups that spread around the world, these fascists inserting themselves into the governments of many, many countries, Die Spinne and Odessa, which is the spider and the web. And these secret webs of Nazi SS men and mass murderers who escaped any justice at the end of that war found a home in Europe and in South America, and in Southern Africa, and in an obliging United States, and also here in Canada as well. Project Paperclip was the name of one major operation that had to do with retrieving the scientists and scientific secrets and developments of the Nazi state. And they brought literally hundreds of top aerospace and munition scientists from Nazi Germany who formed the corporate leadership and the technological expertise that was necessary to set up the emerging military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about when he went out of office in 1959. They also brought Nazi experts in other areas. Kurt Blohm, the Nazi who had developed viral forms of cancer as a germ warfare and chemical warfare agent in Nazi Germany, was brought to Fort Detrick to help the United States form its chemical and biological warfare arsenals in the 1950s. Scientists who had done gruesome experimentation both in Japan and in Germany were either brought here, or their experimentation and results were brought so that the United States could continue with that trend. The Belarus Brigade was a group of white Russian and Nazi troops in Byelorussia, inside the Soviet Union, working under German intelligence control and a counter-revolutionary stronghold since the period in World War I, a Nazi-infested area there in white, what's called White Russia, and almost 300 of the top government officials of that Nazi Quisling government in Byelorussia during the war were brought to the United States and given important intelligence jobs in the CIA and the OSS and Radio Free Europe, Radio Free America, Voice of America. In addition to that, dictatorships arose in South America and throughout the world whose rhetoric of fascism and whose genocidal direction came directly from Nazi collaboration and training, paid for and organized in many cases by the United States government and the CIA, who sent these Nazi torturers and killers into those countries in order to give them the technology of death. The Galen Network was a black orchestra of spies whose dealings during World War II had put the Nazi spies in bed with literally every major intelligence network in the world. MI5, MI6, and the British, the American OSS, which was dependent on the British, and the heavily infiltrated KGB were all targets of Galen, General Reinhard Galen's operations east under Adolf Hitler. The evil genius Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles had begun espionage attacks on the Soviet Union all the way back to the 1920s, and $200 million of Rockefeller and Mellon money was gathered by Alan Dulles to put into the hands of Reinhard Galen when he got here in 1945, and he was dressed in an Army general's uniform and dumped off at the Army Historical Division at the Pentagon. As part of his cover, he brought with him the entire Nazi intelligence files on the Eastern Sector in the Soviet Union. And the deal he cut for that money and further funding was that he would answer any question our intelligence agents wanted to know about the Soviet Union. In exchange, we wouldn't ask him any questions about how he got the answers. This individual and the 350 Nazi spies that he brought in after him formed the basis for the entire Operation Division of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1947. So this is the real framework, the coalescence of these elements in order to gain back what they didn't win at Stalingrad in 1943 since that period. And this is the real historical framework for the events that happened in my lifetime. I was born in 1947. When I had history in school, I was lucky to get out of the Civil War. By the time I got in high school, I think we finally got up to World War II. But the really important period, 1945 to the current period, was not even discussed, much less covered up. I don't know what young people get now. I understand in many high schools in the United States, history is an optional topic. I'm sure democracy will be an optional concept fairly soon. But I found history interesting and went back into it and found a whole other set of connections. And the Cold War led into COINTELPRO and CHAOS, counterintelligence programs, and CHAOS was the CIA. COINTELPRO was FBI, attacks on all domestic attempts to change the social order. It started in the late 40s with the framings of the Rosenbergs as Adam spies and their murder in the electric chair. Ethel Rosenberg said of her execution, this is the first official act of fascism in the United States, at least the most public one. Operation Garden Plot, which was a plan out in California for repression and roundup of anybody protesting the war policies in that period. It went from the McCarthy hearings, just accusing you of being an anti-communist in the 50s, to MK Ultra, which you had a little taste of here with Dr. Ewan Cameron, head of both the World and the Canadian Psychiatric Association, and his psychic driving experiments to clear your mind of any memories and thinking, and then punch back in exactly what they wanted to program. But MK Ultra wanted to find out if they could do it on the mass level as well as the individual level, and they spent 30 years before getting close to perfecting it at Jonestown. It's actually the route that leads, I believe, from the Third Reich to the Fourth, which is the one that I think we're currently existing under. And what these Dulles brothers engineered, the massive Cold War lie of a two huge nation states that had to exhaust their resources in a constant tension with each other, justified any excess in the direction of lack of civil liberties and toward fascism. And Malcolm X, I believe, was right in the statement he made at the time of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, even though he was censured by the Muslims for saying it. He said, "The chickens have come home to roost." And I think they are home, even though I think it shouldn't be their home and we shouldn't make such a nice place for them to sit. I want to move from that background, which I hope gave you a little bit of an overview of the forces and some of the key players, to the Bush family. Prescott Bush Sr., from British monarchy, a monarchist family, registered in the Blue Blood Registers for England, graduated from Yale in 1919. The Skull and Bones, which is the secret society at Yale that taps 15 members per class year, who then later figure into the top positions in the ruling class. Skull and Bones took him on the year that he graduated, and one of the rituals that you do to be initiated in Skull and Bones, at least by report of those who've been there, is that you dig up somebody who was an anti-establishment figure and spend the evening in a coffin with their skull and bones. And word has it that his particular victim was Geronimo, and there were even some attempts by the elders of the Native American tribes to get the bones back in 1989, 1990. I don't know what came of it. When Bush became president, I guess they thought they could ask, at least. It's a democracy. Also central in that graduating class were Averell Harriman and George Brown and the Brown brothers. Harriman banking interests, who were responsible in large part, not solely, but in large part, for the financing of Hitler into power via the Deutsche Bank and their operations on the board of the Deutsche Bank and the Bank of International Credit. Prescott Bush went into congressional office as senator during the Eisenhower and JFK years, Republican. He was supported in his drive to office by William F. Buckley and his National Review. And in 1941, Prescott was one of a committee of 100 men who placed an ad in 26 papers in California asking for someone to run as president. And that ad was responded to, supposedly randomly, by Richard Nixon. Prescott Bush also helped to set up the winning Eisenhower-Nixon ticket in 1950. And there are long-standing connections between Nixon and Bush circles. His son, Prescott Jr., is a member of the Knights of Malta. And I didn't go into a full list of who they are, but believe me, they're the ruling aristocracy of many, many countries within the ranks of the Catholic Church, including this country, people top levels of hidden government intelligence control. And his other son, who we now getting to know so well, George Herbert Walker Bush. Bush, the younger Bush, also graduated from Yale in 1939, was similarly tapped for Skull and Bones. I don't know which division he was in. There's a Wolf's Head division and a Death's Head division, just like the SS, but I don't know which one he got. And he was in, and he was said to have dug up Emma Goldman. Bones. I always say I hope she bit him. But Rockefeller and Kissinger and Buckley, these were the money circles that he grew up in. Rockefeller had worked, as I mentioned, with C.D. Jackson and Nixon with the importation of the Nazis, and later with Rockefeller worked with Edwin Lansdale for the mind control operations from 1948 on. And he began a career in Texas oil speculation. James Baker and Mr. Mosbacher, who are both in the administration now with him, were his early partners in oil barge drilling and exploration offshore. He formed Zapata Offshore Oil. He eventually had extensive dealings throughout Mexico, looking for Mexican oil there, and set up phony fronts. The Mexican government doesn't like speculation to come from outside, and so they often pay somebody to pretend to be the Mexican indigenous Mexican contact, and he operated that way with several people, Mr. Serrano among them. And he knew Kerr McGee. I think he might have known Oswald's case officer and babysitter for the CIA, George de Morenshield, who was a petroleum engineer in Mexico and some of the areas where he was in those years. I think from early on, probably by the 1950s, he was already a CIA asset and operant. This new book that's out within the last few years, Cloak and Gown, has a lot to do with the Yale graduates and moving them into OSS and CIA, the first recruiting ground. And of course, Skull and Bones was one of the main agencies that would be sought in that recruiting effort. It's an inside club. In the 1960s, he was actively working with the CIA on the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. He worked to recruit anti-Castro-Cuban exiles in Florida and in Miami with Mr. Rodriguez, of current Contragate and other infamy. Rodriguez is the person that's reported to have interrogated and then killed Che Guevara. I don't think he interrogated him. I do think he was in the team that killed him. Bolivian secret police and CIA and Green Berets cut him in half with machine gun fire. I talked to one of the Berets that was there, and Rodriguez probably went up afterwards and took off his watch. He's about that bold. And they were also working at that time with key CIA operatives, Theodore Shackley, Rafael Quintero, Frank Sturgis. And there were also links through Buckley to the whole Mexico situation. Buckley is the godfather of E. Howard Hunt's children. Hunt was a CIA station chief in Mexico City in the time right before the Kennedy assassination, and followed up by David Attlee Phillips. And these were the people who were forming the kill teams for Operation Mongoose and Operation 40 to go after Castro ostensibly, but then those same teams got turned back very successfully against John F. Kennedy. The Houston Post reported an FBI memo that a George H.W. Bush of the CIA in 1963 was in Dallas and had reported to the FBI on a conversation by right-wing planners that were attempting to kill JFK. There was another memo that surfaced under Freedom of Information Act from the FBI that said that there was a George Bush, a CIA agent in Miami, working with the anti-Castro-Cuban exiles. On November the 22nd, 1963, he was interviewed in order to find out what their reaction was to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Bush is one of very few people I've ever seen in print say that they cannot recall where they were on November 22, 1963. One of the most infamous of those is Richard Milhouse Nixon. He told the Warren Commission in a deposition he couldn't recall where he was that day. It took him 13 years to remember he'd been in Dallas, Texas. Had been there for several days at meetings with the Murchison Oil family, with J. Edgar Hoover and others planning the assassination of John Kennedy. It helps your memory. At that point in time, I can't remember a thing. But he was there. Richard Helms is another one who says he can't remember. He was at the swimming pool at Bobby Kennedy's home, I think as an ear, waiting to see if Bobby said the wrong thing or would react immediately when he got news from Hoover that his brother was dead. But Bush says, and Rodriguez now says, they can't recall what they were doing that day. I mean, it's a common enough experience within anybody over a certain age. There may be people here who weren't even on the planet yet with us November 22nd, 63, but those that were probably 5 years and older recall it enough that it's a commonly used amnesia breaking technique by psychiatrists, psychologists to get people to remember their lives by taking them back to that point. It doesn't rock the memory of people like this, though. This Bay of Pigs team really comprised of a lot of the Texas oil men, Standard Oil people that had lost property and money when Castro took over. Buckley lost family oil money down there. De Morenshield had started a Cuban-Venezuelan oil company and invested in that and lost a fortune. That was the second time he lost an oil fortune. His family had lost interest in the Nobel oil fields, which are like the Rockefellers of Russia under the Tsar, and been kicked out. Jack Crichton was working with this team out of Texas, an Air Force general named Charles Cabell, whose brother was the mayor of Dallas the day Kennedy was shot. and who was fired from the CIA by Kennedy for these operations. And these were the circles of people that Bush would have been working with back in 1963. He was taking regular trips between Houston and Miami, and also down there in Mexico were the extensive operations of training the assassins going on Oaxaca under the auspices of John Howard Bowen, who had ties with the Central Intelligence Agency, and they trained these assassins down there for the Kennedy hit. In the 1970s, Gerald Ford and Nelson Rockefeller are the appointed presidents for their work by that point. You don't even have to get elected by then. And they appoint Bush to head the CIA following these multiple scandals that are sinking credibility of the agency. And so he comes in then, 1976, up until the beginning of the Carter years when he's replaced by Stansfield Turner. And he closely lost a Senate race, 1970, to Lloyd Benson. He was a representative of the United States at the United Nations. He was an ambassador to China and turned down a chance to speak to Mao Zedong while he was there, but he helped put Deng in power, the person that's in control now, and began to work on the privatization of China by the U.S. Corporate forces and paved the way for some of the ties there that are bearing fruit in the current period with the turn to the right by the Chinese government. In 1980, now we have an even broader scandal about Bush that's emerging in the 90s, that he was involved in something called October Surprise. And probably for most of you, I don't have to go into great detail about it, but it's a report came out in November of 1986 in a Lebanese newspaper that Robert McFarlane had secretly negotiated a deal to hold the Iranian hostages until Reagan was elected. And they attempted to go to damage control and to have an incomplete investigation to stop that. The Reagan and Bush campaign had secretly pursued meetings as early as September of 1980, and there was an October Surprise group within the Reagan-Bush campaign team, 10 strategists, Richard Allen, Dr. Fred Ickel, and John Lehman among them, who in turn were affiliated to many foreign policy and national security consultants. And so there was a way to get White House information out to the campaign, including eventually the theft of the Carter debate books, which involved Sven Kramer, Fritz Gustav Anton Kramer's son. And the final deal was apparently cut in the last 2 weeks of October in Paris. And representing the Reagan-Bush team at that point was George Bush himself, according to former Iranian President Bani Sadr, who now says he wants to come and testify in the United States. None of this was being taken seriously in the last few years when it was initially exposed, but the timeline is October the 3rd, Bush announced publicly that Carter was planning an October surprise to win the election by bringing the hostages home. And then the remaining question is, after that, did Bush go to Paris? Between the days of October 18th and 19th, those 2 days, Bush can't account for a 21-hour period. And according to many sources, he was flown to Paris at that point by Jack Tolliver or a pilot named Ken Qualls to have a meeting with Casey, Richard Allen, Fred Ickel, McFarland, who was John Tower's aide at that point, and the Iranians, to give arms in exchange for this hostage holdup. The people who say he did that include Mr. Brennecke, a former CIA agent, Bani Sadr, Mr. Rafizadeh from Savak, the CIA's William Herman, even if Brennecke is to be believed, Donald Gregg, the National Security Advisor to Bush, confirmed, and several Mossad agents that were contacted. There's varying levels of attacks on these people's credibility, but I think the orchestration of the release of hostages on the very day that, and within hours of Reagan's inauguration, as well as the shipment right after that of the arms, should tell us it's certainly not something outside the purview of what they would try to do. And many of the people who started to expose it and talk about it are already dead. And I expect more deaths will follow as the investigation opens. March 31st, 1980, then I would contend Bush becomes effectively president and runs the White House. Zapata Offshore Oil in the 1960s bailed out another oil company that was floundering called Vanderbilt Oil. Vanderbilt Oil then, avoiding bankruptcy, changed its name to Vanderbilt Resources, and in 1980 had six dry wells but a $14 million a year income. Which I think was a funnel for CIA, and this Vanderbilt Oil is run by Scott Hinckley and his father, John Hinckley Sr. Besides being on the board of World Vision that I mentioned before, which had CIA and USAID funding all through the 50s and 60s, and some up into the current period, and that spied in Vietnam and throughout Southeast Asia for the CIA, that ran the Cuban and Haitian refugee camps using the Bay of Pigs operatives to actually physically control the camps. They also ran the camps that housed the Thai refugees at Fort Chaffee. And one of the people that worked for World Vision there was Mark David Chapman, the individual that later assassinated John Lennon. They were in charge of the Sabra and Shatila camps, where the fascist Falange went in and killed the Palestinians. And they have many overseas operations to recruit and train assassins worldwide. Hinckley is also very close to the Christian right and very close friends with Chuck Colson, among others, the Watergate figure. Lenin's death and silence was used to usher in the emerging Reagan and Bush warfare state in the 1980s and 90s. Hinckley's son, Scott, was very close with the Bush family and good friends with Neil Bush. In fact, Neil Bush and Scott Hinckley were supposed to have dinner the night of the Reagan shooting on March 31st, and according to some reports, canceled their plans, and other reports said they didn't. But if I told you that Robert Oswald, Lee's older brother, was going to have dinner with Lyndon Johnson's daughter the night of the Kennedy assassination, I think you'd get the point. In fact, all of Scott Hinckley's dating arrangements were being made by George Bush's daughter, and they came into those days in March of 1980, and there was a little fight going on in the White House in the weeks before about something called a crisis management team. And at first, Haig was going to head up the crisis management team, but then at the last minute, about 3 days before the shooting, Bush was put in to head the crisis management team, and the press couldn't quite figure out what it was, and they were chasing him around saying, what's a crisis, and what's crisis management, and what's this all got to do with? And what it has to do with, of course, is transfer of power and control in either natural or created crises in the White House and at the level of the presidency. So they asked Bush 3 days before the shooting, how would you define a crisis? And Bush says, the president will know it when he sees it. Flat on his back, I suppose, was the scenario. And I think he did see it coming out of that Hilton there in Washington, and I did extensive work on the ballistics. None of Hinckley's bullets hit Mr. Reagan. Hinckley had six bullets in the gun. One hit Delahanty, a cop, and threw him to the ground by nicking him on his, grazing his shoulder and neck. Another went into the groin of the agent McCarthy. A 160-pound man lifted him up and threw him back to the other end of the limousine. Another bullet, the initial bullet fired by Hinckley, hit Mr. Brady in the head, knocked him to the ground, did considerable brain damage. And one bullet nicked the windshield of the limousine. One bullet went into the Universal office building across the street, and one bullet went into the trunk of the car, and you can see when you look at the photos closely, a very clear hole, not a ricochet or a scar mark, but a hole going into the car, penetrating the outer metal wall. The bullet that hit Reagan hit him, by all counts, at an early point. When the limousine pulled up, to deliver him to his talk, It pulled up at the door where he was to go in. I suppose if you rented a limousine, you'd expect it to come to your door, not two doors down the block. If you're the President of the United States, they will move it 6 inches to make it sure it lines up with the door. They were following standard security procedure when he got there. The limousine stopped, the door opened. The Secret Service got out on both sides and formed a human wall. And then Reagan gets out and walks through that wall a couple of seconds into the door, the VIP entrance, and through some non-public halls and up an elevator and out on the stage. It comes back by the same route in order to beat the crowd out. This was specifically designed there at the Hilton for that purpose, this route. But when he comes out, the limousine inexplicably is about 40 feet down the curb, nowhere near the door. So he has to walk out into the open. When the President walks in the open, the Secret Service are supposed to stand on either side and to the front and back, as well as other points, but at least a protective diamond. The Secret Service file out all to his right, line of ducks. They told him that morning, "No security problem, Mr. President, you needn't wear your vest." He raised his hand to wave, someone called Mr. President, raised his hand to wave, and at that point he's hit. You can tell he's hit. Similar to the effect of Connolly and the Kennedy assassination, because the missile went into his lung. The lung begins to collapse, the air is blown out, and the cheeks expand. And you get a grimace on the face. His shoulder slumps a little bit. He's clearly in pain. And all of the magazines, Time magazine, you go back to that point, show Reagan is hit. He's up like this. But that point is at almost the same second that Hinckley's first bullet is fired and hits Brady in the head. And realizing that Reagan is not dead, Secret Service Agent Parr begins to push him into the car in front of him. And Reagan's already in the car, and Parr about a third of the way into the car when Hinckley's last shot is fired. So there's no chance in timing or angles or anything else for these bullets to hit Reagan. The reaction of all the other people is much different than Reagan. Reagan's still standing, and then he gets into the car. So they're all lying around the ground from these 38 shots. If a 38 caliber, even a 22 caliber bullet had hit Reagan, he wouldn't have been wondering whether something had happened to him. A good assassin, even if you have your vest on, knows that when you raise your hand, you expose your heart. and the situation was that up top of the retaining wall on the area that I call the Bushy Knoll, was the assassin. And he was firing not a 38 or a 22, but a very, very specific weapon developed by the intelligence agencies, which is a CO2-propelled flechette. These are little razor-edged or sharp discs, or they have them, earlier versions were like little tube rockets, about a half an inch long, very thin with stabilizing fins. Then they got into these little discs that are razor-edged and delta-shaped or airline-shaped so that they... And this thing makes no noise. It's just a little puff of the CO2 gas, and it can be fired with accuracy up to an amazing distance. Some of the guns that incorporated this early technology were revealed by Senator Church during the CIA assassination studies in Congress, and they had a looked like a German Luger with a rifle scope on it that would fire these things accurately with the scope to the length of a football field. So there's no problem with aiming them or getting them to do the job. And I have to assume that Luger was the expendable technology and they got better, or they wouldn't show it to us on TV. And they can shoot you from a satellite, they don't have to worry about a gun barrel. But not with a 22, of course, but with other types of energy and heat generating stuff they can send down by satellite. And if they can knock a ICBM missile traveling through outer space out of the sky, I'm sure they can catch you on the street. So once they get Star Wars in place, the cities are the first target, I think. They can start firestorms and other things. But this guy made such a little wound with this disc, when they often contain poison and might have in Reagan's case that later led to the cancer, but also can just be used. I think the idea was to penetrate the heart, but it deflected on the seventh rib and went into the lung and missed the aorta by about a quarter of an inch. They couldn't find the bullet. The nurses couldn't find a bullet wound. Now, this is GWU Hospital emergency room in D.C. They've seen bullet wounds, believe me. They didn't know what was wrong. They thought he was having a heart attack. Finally, when they got all his clothes cut off, the nurse saw what she described, and I read the medical magazines about this, and she said it was a little razor slit, about an inch long, with some black blood coming out of it, a little line of blood. And then she thought, well, you know, maybe he's been hit with something. But that isn't what a 22 or a 38 hole would look like. And then they went in and they couldn't find it, and they almost closed him up. They did three different x-rays to find the bullet. And then the doctor, the last time, just before closing, got the thing in his hand and his lung tissue and pulled it out. And he described it in the medical magazine as round, flat as a dime, as round as a dime, about that size, and flat, razor-edged. And then he hands it to the FBI that's waiting patiently. And it goes the way of all good bullets, back into the history bin. So we don't hear about that bullet anymore. We hear about these 22 exploding shells and ricochet shot that must have hit the back of the car and gone between the door of the car and gotten into Reagan on his way in. Because otherwise, how do you explain the wound described by Dr. O'Donnell that night at the press conference as a 45-degree downward, back to front, left to right wound? When you have Reagan here and Hinckley down about where you are, how are you going to get me from back there? So, you know, it just didn't fit. So then you got to bend Reagan over like this, bullet ricochet, and come back in from the other side of the car or something. I mean, you know, it was almost as impossible as the magic bullet in the Kennedy assassination, but these are minor details when you're killing a president. They did not expect him to survive. They got into the car without even police escort, and they yelled, "Rawhide is okay," Rawhide being his code name at the time. "Rawhide is okay." You know, oops, gig's up. So next, plan B, and Brady at that point is lying on the ground bleeding, and there is an early report that Brady is dead. Then there's a report that Reagan is shot, then that Brady's shot or not dead, or Reagan's not dead, or Reagan's dead, and it went back and forth like that for a while, and the press couldn't seem to get it straight. And I'm turning on everything I can turn on, radio and TV, you know, the minute I hear it, because I know you're going to get the only news in the first few minutes. And the situation is somebody comes into GWU Hospital on a stretcher, Secret Service all around, and they come in a few minutes before and they clear out the emergency room, and they bring this guy through on the stretcher. So everybody assumes it's Reagan, he's hit, maybe he's dead, and he's going into surgery. But in fact, having looked at the case very closely, I now realize that that was Brady. Brady beat Reagan to the hospital. Brady, who took three more minutes to even get an ambulance near him, got to GWU before Reagan did. And then in the book that McCarthy writes about protecting the president that day, he says that they got in the car and they said they were going to take him to the nearest hospital, that's what you've got to do. And so they went up T Street to Connecticut, and they said into the thing, "We're going right. We're going to," and then he says another code word, doesn't put it in there, but he says it means the White House. And if you go right on Connecticut Avenue at T Street in Washington, D.C., you're heading north, away from the White House, and up to another place in Maryland where the body of John Kennedy got taken, called Bethesda Naval Hospital, so that the United States Navy intelligence can finish the job on Mr. Reagan. In fact, Secret Service agents argued with hospital staff at GWU all night until 6 in the morning. They finally gave up trying to move him up to Bethesda. They wanted to do the killing and the autopsy up there where they could control it. They didn't want him down in a public hospital. But a huge fight broke out between the Reagan loyalists and the Bush loyalists in the Situation Room in that hour, at the command and control module, which is the communication module in the White House for all the nuclear and crisis commands, sat Helena Vandamme. Reagan's appointment secretary in Otto von Bolschwing's employ. And the fight ensued to the point that a deal was made to let Reagan live, as long as he got out of the way. Haig emerged, shaken, Bush's man, and said, "Gentlemen, I am in charge here until the vice president returns." Bush was flying out in Dallas on Air Force One, and so the transition of power, I believe, happened at that point. Hinckley was an easy enough patsy to set up and blame the murder on. Reagan managed to survive, but then from then on, basically, went out to Camp David, watched old movies with Nancy, waved at the press, you know, "Oh, I'm the president, want to see my boots?" And Bush ran the White House. The Contragate scandal then came in, created, I believe, by Bush. Oliver North is Bush's boy. And when you look at the testimony of North concerning this scandal, there's a point at which George Bush calls Oliver North at a hotel room, and he describes this call. He says, "I picked up the phone and I jumped to attention for the president." Kissinger and Kramer and Haig and Bush and Scowcroft and Brzezinski and North is the team that moves in this scandal. North is both CIA and DIA, National Security Council link. And he does several jobs for Bush, I believe. One being Operation Eagle Claw, the sabotage of a rescue attempt on the hostages in Iran that was never meant to rescue them. A covert operation handed over to Carter without his knowledge of what was up, run by Operation Yellow Fruit and the Independent Support Agency and the Delta Force and the secret counterterrorism teams that were created under Bush and all the Bush operatives. The Navy Task Force 59 under North. This was not a rescue mission. It was 800 miles from Tehran on a desert road near the Afghan border. It was a switch, I believe, of guns for drugs. You don't need five C-130 planes to refuel eight Huey helicopters. These choppers were defective. They were taken up out of the barrels of the Independence at sea just to make sure the sand shields were pulled off the engine covers so that they would crash in the incident. And these Hueys, at best, on a full tank, will go 600 miles. I looked them up in Janes. So you've got to refuel twice, once on the way in to take over Iran with eight helicopters, and then once on the way out. Well, once we lost the three choppers, I mean, even Americans can't take Tehran with just five Hueys. We almost had them by the tail. This was run by Mr. Secord, among others, and it effectively embarrassed Carter. And then more recently, Mr. Bush brings us into the oil war, and he says, "This time we won't be fighting with one hand tied behind our back like the Vietnam War." Well, with the level of genocide that went on in Vietnam and the millions of craters that destroyed the rice capital of the world, now imports all of its rice, I don't know which hand was tied behind a back. I mean, I didn't see the United States backing off at all, except in 1954, when Richard Nixon went to Eisenhower and asked him to drop nuclear bombs in order to save the French there and the French rule, and similar plans that were stated by General LeMay and some of the right wing to bomb it back to the Stone Age or use nuclear weapons. I don't think anything much worse could have been done to Vietnam by the United States, but Bush wants us to think that we had a hand tied behind our back, and I think it has to be that nuclear hand and near nuclear weapons of current technology, no radiation, but as destructive as nuclear weapons, were tested extensively for the first time in the war against Iraq. And they caused massive genocide there. We manipulated the news about them in the United States, and so the people don't understand the level of destruction that went on. An Australian peace team that went in heard of these butterfly and toy bombs being used there. Children in the hospitals in Iraq had their hands or parts of their limbs or feet blown off by these little bombs that were used during Vietnam as well by the United States. They look like a toy, they're bright colors, and children tend to pick them up or go over near them and then they explode. And they're specifically anti-personnel weapons, as were the cluster bomb units. These huge bombs that drop down to a certain altitude, pop open, out come all these little balls with airlines, and they spin through the air in different directions, spread out, then they explode, and inside those are tinier flechettes or ball bearings. Now, these won't puncture a tire in a truck or even go through a sandbag, but they penetrate and are designed to penetrate human flesh. They used them in Vietnam, and the Vietnamese got good at surgically removing the ones in the veins and saving lives. And so at that point, Honeywell, the American corporation that was producing them, went to plastic versions so that they couldn't be seen by the X-ray. The New World Order that Bush and these elements want to bring in includes the tremendous concentration of wealth and technology has happened in the Ruhr Valley in the 30s in Germany. A population and labor force that is currently seen as expendable. The end of civil and constitutional liberties and rights as we know them. Tremendous carnage and terror around the world by the wars that will follow and the establishment of police states and open martial law. Here in North America, you beat us, I guess, to at least an example of martial law up here. You had the first one, but we've got the permanent one down below the border. And a worldwide genocide that will eventually take out between 60% and 80% of the planet if it's allowed to continue. The agenda for this New World Order and for the end of this era up to the year 2000 is first a tight stranglehold on all the known resources of the world, and they're all known now with satellite technology, and either exploitation of local labor in order to bring that out, or genocide of that labor and mechanized and technology coming in to do it. Instead, a first strike capability with Star Wars, the MX missiles, the bombers, and the huge submarines that they want to put out into the ocean, so that they'll have first nuclear strike capability. And they talk about something called Airland Battle 2000, which is full-scale chemical, biological, and nuclear attack on the Soviet Union by the turn of the century. Or the other element, which Bush is aligned with, will settle for Alan Dulles's dream of 1954 being realized, the destabilization of Eastern Europe, the final fall of the communist rule in the Soviet Union, so that it itself can be exploited, tremendous labor resources, oil and timber, and other resources. This is their version. This is who really runs America. The reason they put this kind of energy into running America is to cover up the biggest secret of all. The biggest secret of all is that who runs America is us. And once we get onto this game, once we realize this gig, and withdraw our sanction and our support, and say no, they're finished.
Undercurrents Radio can be heard on CIUT 89.5 FM on Thursday mornings from 1 a.m. till 6 a.m.
You're watching Cable 10 Parkdale Trinity, your community television station.